by Senate Foreign Relations Committee Chair Richard Lugar. His topic was Nicaragua. That's coming up at 4 o'clock. Well, with me now on Fresh Air is jazz pianist George Shearing, who's in Philadelphia to play tonight with Mel Torme as part of the Mellon Jazz Festival. New Yorker jazz critic Whitney Balliot has described Shearing as having a masterly touch. Shearing was born in London in 1919 and was blind from birth. He studied classical music, but was most inspired by the records of jazz pianists like Art Tatum and Fats Waller. In the 40s, he was voted Britain's top pianist for 7 years of annual polls in the jazz magazine Melody Maker, but he wanted to establish himself in the United States. After World War II, he began a series of visits to New York, where he first assembled his quintet. The group featured the unusual instrumentation of piano, vibes, electric guitar, bass, and drums. Shearing kept his quintet together for about 30 years, breaking it up in 1978 so he could play more solo, duet, and trio concerts. Verve has just released a double album of Shearing's quintet sessions from the early 1950s. George Shearing is not only a very popular pianist, he's a composer as well, best known for Lullaby of Birdland, which has become a jazz standard. George Shearing has been an American citizen since 1956. He's played, by the way, also, in addition to jazz clubs, he's played with symphony orchestras. He's played quite a while at the Café Carlyle, which is the classiest, most sophisticated New York setting for music. His concert with Mel Torme this evening is at the Academy of Music at 8 o'clock. And for more information about that concert, you can call the Academy at 893-1930. For information about any of the other Mellon Jazz concerts, you can call the Mellon Jazz line at 751-9883. George Shearing, it's a pleasure to meet you. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Terry. Nice to see you and to meet you. Isn't it a pity they didn't call this one Mellon George instead of Mellon Jazz?
What I'd like to do is talk to you a little bit about your past and growing up, and then we'll make our way into the present.
You know, with that introduction, I don't know how much you need from my past. You seem to have really done your homework, which is just marvelous.
You were born in London, and I know you were born blind. Did you go to special schools for the blind? Was there any compulsory setup for that in London?
Yes, good question. There was a compulsory residential education between the age of 12 and 16. Before that, I went to a regular day school for blind and myopic children. There were myopics in the residential school also. I still believe in residential education for the blind before they go out into the world, because parents, well-meaning parents, over-nurse and over-protect and, oh, don't let him do this, you know, he's blind and all that. They taught us to make our own beds, to clean the silverware, the knives and forks and spoons with the whitening and a rag, to clean our own shoes. And they really taught us to take care of ourselves, you know. I hope I'm not in earshot of my wife, because I haven't made beds in quite a while. And while we have a housekeeper and a wife, I'm not really about to. But I can, and, you know, if it's necessary.
So
I sound as if I don't help her, but I really do. When we have more than ourselves for dinner, I'm in the kitchen all the time helping to dry dishes and do things that, you know, I think every man who isn't too much of a chauvinist pig should do, you know.
So you had a good balance growing up,
yes.
Between being cared for but not being overprotected.
That's right. I think the residential school really took care of that.
Was it in school that you first started playing piano?
Yes. I studied with the same teacher from the age of 4 until I left school at 16. Now, I was born, as you know, in 1919. I went to school when I was 4, 1923. I left school when I was 16, 1935. And then I went back to that same school for a visit in 1962, and that same teacher was still there. This teacher had said to my parents at the age of, just before I was 16, He said, you know, the further study of classical music is a waste of time for this child. It's obviously he's going to become a jazz pianist. Well, when I went back in 1962, I asked him this question. I said, Mr. Newell, do you remember what you said to my parents when I was 60? And he said, yes. I said, I'm reasonably certain that it must have come to your attention in the interim that I've played Mozart and Bach concertos with many of the leading symphony orchestras through the country. He said, yes. I said, if you had to give the same advice today, what would your advice be? He said, I suspect your largest dollar, however, still comes from jazz. I said, yes. He said, my advice would be the same. He's a very wise man, but he did compliment me for studying classical music and not being satisfied with just that which I'd been given, but seeking some more. And I do pass that on to young people. Don't just get by. Get by and make sure that you have all the room in the world to get by.
When you were first starting to play piano, did you ever come up against skepticism that a blind child would be able to master the piano?
I don't think it's a question of whether a blind child could master the piano as whether a blind child can make a living in anything other than playing in the pubs, which is where I started. You've got to remember one thing, Terry, and that is that if I chose, say, to be a studio musician, it's obviously necessary to read music. And yes, I can read Braille music, but that's not sight reading sighted music. You might find 30 pages of manuscript paper with so many notes on it, just as if, you know, flies were all over it. And we always say that there are some sighted people who read so well that if a fly appeared on the paper, they'd read it, you know. This is not available to the blind. But playing in the pub was, and eventually getting my own group was. You'd be surprised what kind of prejudice one comes against. I had a job at the now defunct Hickory House in New York, not a job, an audition. And I was told that the Hickory House wanted to switch from being a jazz club to being an East Side club, and that I should try to put some show tunes together and do that as my audition. Well, I did exactly that. And the owner said, gee, he said, you know, I was really looking for more of a jazz pianist. And I don't know whether you saw a movie some time ago called Gentleman's Agreement, but this is the kind of thing that happens when you get any kind of minority group. If they don't want it, there's always a reason. So he suddenly switched. He wanted a jazz pianist. I said, that is my main suit. How about if I remove my coat and play some jazz? Well, no, he said, could you come in next Monday and do an off night? I said, sure, I did that. Played for about 5 or 6 hours. And they said, oh, we'll call you. You know, you're in. I never did play there. I found out a theory later on from another blind pianist who no longer with us, Lenny Tristano. He said, you know why you never got the gig? I said, no. He said, because the moment he saw that you were blind, and he said, I know what I'm talking about because I've been through it, he was worried whether you would have an accident on the premises and ruin his insurance.
No kidding. You think that's what it was?
Yep. So, of course, I passed all that by with the, you know, big records like Lullaby and September in the Rain and that stuff. Because the moment you find a way to carve your niche, you don't have to worry about it. It's when you have to go to people for a job that you have to really worry and you have to be twice. When they come to you, it means that you've already done some kind of a good job. And provide you keep up your standards, you work forever.
You know what I thought you were going to say, that that Tristano told you that the club owner thought it would be depressing to have a blind performer.
Well,
there.
I imagine there's that part of it too. And then in a bar, which is frequented by businessmen, they're probably better off having a lady pianist than a man pianist. You know, all these things. You'd be surprised. You'd be surprised what goes through people's minds.
My guest is pianist and composer George Shearing. Well, you were studying classical music, but I think when you were studying, you were also listening to a lot of jazz at the time. What were you listening to? Who were some of the players that inspired you the most then?
Well, let's go a little bit back to after I left the pub where I made the equivalent of $5 a week in a box on top of the piano. Be surprised how many times I had to play Melancholy Baby. I left after about a year and went with a semi-professional band, and then we started to play kind of stock arrangements. And from there, I went with an all-blind band, 15 blind guys learning to play instruments from being basket makers and chair caners. We were playing arrangements of Jimmy Lunsford and Duke Ellington and people like that.
How did you find each other? Who organized the band?
The National Institution for the Blind, which has now since become the Royal National Institution for the Blind, in that it is supported by the royal family, partly. people used to write all the parts out in Braille. I was the only one who didn't read his part. I could pick it up by ear because I learned a lot of the records as well. There were a couple of people in that band, the first trumpet player and the drummer, who had everything from, early Miff Mole and stuff like that, all the way through Teddy Wilson and Tatum and Fats Waller. And these people all kind of became my mentors, as you can imagine. So it was that was a really wonderful training ground.
Was that good for you to be playing in a professional band that was comprised of musicians who were also blind?
The band, for its time and what it was, and not having the background that sighted musicians have, was very good. It was just rather sadly mismanaged. And it's a shame it was, because World War II was soon to be upon us. And with all the musicians being drafted, this band could really have cleaned up, as it was. We used to play theatres all over London. And yes, I think it was good. I just feel that there was a little too much emphasis on blind. I always say, you know, I'm a pianist, not a jazz pianist. I'm a pianist who happens to play jazz. I'm a pianist, not a blind pianist. I'm a pianist who happens to be blind, you see. So these extra descriptive words sometimes can be dangerous, particularly the word blind. You know, who needs it?
Just as you were really coming of age and, well, you'd already started your recording career, the war came along. How was the music scene in London changed by the war? And was there any place to perform or even places to listen during the war?
I had more work than I could handle because there were so many people called up. I would be doing studio work in the daytime because there was enough of it that didn't demand reading. And they couldn't afford to be that fussy any longer. So I learned the charts and did the recordings and the jazz broadcasts and whatever was involved. I did theater, two shows in the theater, 8 and 10 at night. I went on to a supper club and played from 10:30 until about 1:30. And then on to a nightclub and played till 4. And then back in the studios the next morning at 10. I had much more work than I could handle. And I was playing with, there was a band called George Evans and his Saxes and Sevens. There were 7 saxophones and a rhythm section. It was a wonderful band. And I learned all the charts and played them with the band.
Were you ever bombed while you were performing during the war?
Oh, yes. First of all, my mother was bombed out 3 times. And one place I played, called the St. Regis, we had just finished our night's work, and I was upstairs changing, ready to go home. And we felt the building shake and we heard this tremendous blast. And we went downstairs to go home. And as we left the building, water was pouring on our head from burst pipes. When we went back to try to pick up our tuxedos and stuff that we'd left upstairs, we had the devil's own job getting them to let us back because there was talk of another unexploded bomb. They let us in and we stayed the night in the hotel. And we tried to call downstairs for some breakfast the next morning and there was no room service. We had to walk downstairs because the elevator was not working. When we left the building, we found out why the elevator was not working. That's where the time bomb was.
Oh.
I was in a cab one night going to work, and we stopped at a traffic light. We heard this tremendous blast, and the cab shook like mad. And I said, boy, that was a close one, wasn't it? And there was no answer. And I said, that was a close one. I put my hand in front, and the driver's gone. He ducked in a doorway, and when it was all clear, he came out again. I said, thanks a lot.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, didn't you also do some playing inside air raid shelters during the
war? Oh, yes.
What kind of setup was that, that there'd be a piano there?
I met my first wife in an air raid shelter. And what we did, we played in the basement, which had been turned into a gymnasium. And there were kind of forms, you know, benches that one could sleep on or on the floor, and there were blankets and stuff. And there would be an upright piano there. So I was living with a song plugger at the time, and he and I would play four hands, much to the amusement of people that went, you know, down in that particular air raid shelter. you know, you'd be surprised what a wonderful sense of humor the Cockneys had. And I lost my Cockney accent. I was a Cockney when I was a little boy. I lost it because I heard the BBC announcers speaking much more perfect English than I was, and I was determined to get that from them. But the old story is, and though it may be apocryphal, it could easily be true. The old Cockney guy, Navvy, maybe working on the road, came home and they were getting ready to go to the air raid shelter. And he called to his wife and he says, come on, Liza. He said, the siren's just gone off. And she said, wait a minute, Jim. I'm looking for my false teeth. He said, come on, Liza. They're dropping bombs, not sandwiches. Wonderful sense of humor.
Did you have requests in the air raid shelters?
Oh, yes.
So you think it helped pass the time for everybody?
Oh, yeah. Oh, well, sure. I mean, you had to make a life. I mean, you had no alternative. 15 hours a day, the raid would be on. Day and night, until we defeated the day raiders.
My guest is pianist George Shearing. Well, after the war, you decided, I guess, not to stay in London, and you wanted to at least make a few trips to the United States. What was the lure of America for you?
I met a few American musicians just before and a few more during the war. And all as if they were in one voice, pretty well said, man, you should go over to the States. You kill them over there. Well, you know, I had acquired some ability to play in the styles of Teddy Wilson, Art Tatum, Fats Waller, and Bob Zirke, and people like that. But they had all this over here. Before the war, I had only two aged parents who didn't want to fly or even sail. So America was out at that time, plus the fact of the nearing the poverty line and everything. After the war, well, I married first time in 1941. After the war, my wife and I came over for a 3-month visit because I'd been into jazz since 1937. And with people like Fats Waller and Coleman Hawkins saying to me, you've really got to go to the States. You'll love it there and you'll kill everybody over there. So I was dying to do it even before the war, but as I say, it was not possible. You can't believe when I first came over on the U.S., on the United States ship, 1946, I put my foot on American soil and I thought, this is where it all is. My dreams have come true. I am here. When I came back on immigration, I had letters to top flight agents. And I went around giving one audition after another. And they all said the same thing. Gee, go and build yourself into a $10,000 a week act. Come over and we'll handle you. One of them said, I wish I could play like that. What else can he do? And I know what they meant.
What?
They have all these things over here. They had Art Tatum. They had the American Art Tatum, the original. They had the American Teddy Wilson. They had the American Fats Waller. Why do they need English copies of these things? So it became very evident to me very quickly that what I needed was an identity. And the identity was, of course, the George Herring Quintet.
Yeah, now describe how you put that quintet together.
Well,
what was the inspiration behind it and the reason you chose that unusual instrumentation?
Well, that's thanks to Leonard Feather. But let me go back. I started playing as an intermission pianist in 1948 opposite Sarah Vaughan in the Onyx Club. She was just working with Jimmy Jones on piano. A wonderful accompanist. Then with opposite Ella Fitzgerald. And that group was Ella Fitzgerald, Ray Brown on bass, Hank Jones on piano, and Charlie Smith on drums. In the same Three Deuces where I worked with them, I worked another time opposite Errol Garner, Oscar Pettiford, and J.C. Hurd. I mean, I really went through the ringer over here. And some poor little English blind piano player is going to come over here and take care of these people after they get off the stand. Not in your life. I did it, and I gradually kind of became favored by the American musicians. When Hank Jones had his night off, I would get somebody to play my intermission so I could play the show with Ella. What fun that was. My goodness. I'll never forget when I first sat in with Charlie Parker. Being a reserved Englishman, I should have said, what would you like to play, Mr. Parker? But I was a 28-year-old hippie who came from England. I never dressed like a hippie in my life. That's not the point. But the point is, I did say to him, what do you want to blow, bird? And he thought, you know, he was a gentleman. He wasn't destructive. But I guess he felt it was necessary to put me through the paces and kind of just take me down a peg in case I became too cocky. And as I'm sure he didn't think in this other than to be good schooling for me. So when I said, what do you want to play, Bird? He said, oh, how about all the things you are in five sharps? I don't know whether you play any piano, Terry, but that's a difficult piece of music to play in B major. I did it. I had the background, and I did it. And it was passing a few of these tests and winning favor with the American musicians by ability, which stood me in good stead. And again, I don't know whether you like people preaching on your program, but again, I have to pass that over to the young. Win the favor and respect of those with whom you have to deal in business, and you're never going to go wrong.
Did you expect that there would be these little initiations you'd be put to and tests that you'd have to pass in order to get the respect of American jazz musicians on American soil?
I don't think I expected it because of so many musicians telling me how I would kill them over here. It takes one off guard, you know. But when you think about it, if any young person's going to come to me and want, I did it. I had it in England. A young guy came to me, 18 years old, said, I'd like to take lessons. So I said, fine. I said, what do you want to do with your life in music? Well, he said, I don't want to waste my time playing around with the local bands. He said, if I can be another George Shearing, I wasted my time playing with the local band. I said, can you read? Oh, yeah, I can read anything. So I put up some very difficult journey exercises. Very difficult to read, very difficult to play. And he stumbled all over the place. And he said, well, boy, that's hard, isn't it? I said, yes. You'll find that as a musician, you'll probably be required to do a lot more than read the chords of Sweet Sue. I lost him as a pupil, but hopefully I did him some good, which is my main concern. So, yes, there's no reason why I shouldn't be put through the ringer, you know.
Let's get back to the quintet that you
organized. Oh, right. I got off that, didn't
I? You were talking about how you figured out you needed an identity.
Yeah. Well, that was, I started, as I say, as a pianist. And then one time I was going to go into a club in New York. I think it was the Click Club, which later became, I don't know, it's Birdland. I was going into this club with my own trio. And the owner said, I have a chance to buy Buddy DeFranco at a very, reasonable cost. Would you mind if I put him with him? Would I mind? It sounded like a Benny Goodman quartet or something once we got going with it. It's fabulous. Depending on whom you spoke to, whether Buddy's wife or my wife, it would be the George Shearing Buddy DeFranco quartet or the Buddy DeFranco George Shearing quartet. Buddy was negotiating with Capitol Records at the time. We were negotiating with MGM. Later on, it was to be the total reverse, but obviously two careers possibly so close together and yet negotiating separately couldn't be very long-lived, So we've remained friends ever since, but we went our own separate ways. And Leonard Feather said, well, we have this marvelous rhythm section of John Levy on bass and Denzel Best on drums. He said, you've heard Marjorie Himes play with her own trio and with Woody Herman, and you've heard Chuck Wayne play with his own trio. Let's get it together and see what happens. So we got together, and he said, what do you want to play? I said, well, I don't know. September in the Rain. 900,000 copies later on MGM, the quintet was born.
What did you do with the arrangements for the band? What kind of sound were you going for in your mind?
Well, let me say first that we were going for music, not hits.
Although you had hits.
Well, I mean, we had them by accident. We didn't try to contrive. We didn't try to create a hit. So many people do that. Let me see, if I get myself a Fender bass, an electric guitar, a Click guitar, and the rock drums, whether they believe in it or not, they get it because this is what's going to hit. This is what's going to make it, see. Make it with yourself first and with your music second. Anyway, the quintet, what did I do? I borrowed a style from Milt Buckner. Milt Buckner was the originator of the locked hand style, not me. I just played some more popular tunes with it. He used it for the blues. I used it for Roses of Picardy and I'll Remember April. I got the vibes, playing the melody in the upper register, the guitar an octave below, and I was playing all five voices, three voices in between, and the vibes and guitar. I wrote out bass lines, And it was a very well-knit group that lasted for 29 years.
The group headed in pop directions in a lot of its records. What was your reason for choosing that?
Capitol Records wanted it. They wanted me to add strings and add this and add that. And there were a number of very successful records because of that. But we started to lose favor with the critics, as you can imagine, when we did that.
What about your jazz musician friends? What was their reaction?
Well, you know, some of them knew what I was doing. What I was doing was trying to broaden the listening audience for jazz. But the critics just felt I was going very commercial. And I met Dave Brubeck on the street one day, and I said, you just lost a poll. I said, I want to congratulate you. I said, because if you get some less favorable mention, you might be able to afford to hire a band boy. He said, I just did. You know, so it depends on what you want. I mean, how long do you have to be in a musical minority to prove your sincerity? Now, I went along with Capitol. They wanted it that way. But I did tire of it because my job as pianist and leader of the George Shearing Quintet was limited in scope. And in retrospect, the critics were right because there was a lot less creativity involved in the more commercial side of my music.
Is it why you broke up the quintet?
I just got tired of it. It was on automatic pilot. I could go to sleep playing the show. And I tried several things. I surrounded it with brass. I surrounded it with Latin sounds. And people love that. But I could work all day long on a fugue or a very intricate piece of music. When I came to work, will you play Roses of Picardy? Play I Remember April. You could work all day long. This is what they wanted. And I'm glad they wanted it, but it's tiresome. And it's confining. It's as if you have fetters around your neck. You just can't move, you know. And so I finally wanted to address myself to the proposition of being a complete pianist rather than a band leader who rests on his laurels until he gets tired enough to go to sleep.
So when you broke up the quintet, it gave you opportunities to play in solo, duet, and trio kind
right.
of settings.
Now, my present bassist, a wonderful bass player, Don Thompson, whom I met when I was playing a concert for some friends in Toronto. I was playing just a solo concert, and they said that Don Thompson was in the audience. He had his bass, and I knew of Don Thompson from the Boss Brass. He did all the recordings with the Boss Brass. I shook hands with him and we played a 2-hour concert together, having never played before. Such were the two musical minds. And Don Thompson gives me quite a run for my money on piano. We play two pianos very often on concert.
Well, my guest is pianist George Shearing. What I'd like to do is take a break from our interview and play one of your recent recordings, and we're going to feature a piano solo. And this is Happy Days Are Here Again. And
usually heard in a very fast show business type tempo. But I first heard Barbara Streisand sing this slowly. And so I conceived this arrangement on that order. And at the end, there's a little snatch from a thing called Walk in the Black Forest or something like that. Do 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 beep 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 beep. So there's a little bit of that stuff at the end, which of course is also a little steal from Happy Days Are Here Again.
Let's hear it. This is Happy Days Are Here Again, played by my guest, George Shearing.
Thank you.
That was pianist George Shearing. It seems to me that in the last few years, you've been adding more and more popular song to your repertoire, playing with singers like Mel Torme, singing yourself. You've recently, I think it's recently, began singing.
Yeah, within the last 10 or 15 years, you know, recently, by comparison with my career. This is my 50th year in show business.
What attracts you to it? What attracts you to a song when
lyrics,
you're choosing it?
Lyrics, and how the lyrics fit with the music. You know, and being able to make literary sense out of the song. For instance, everybody, and I do mean everybody that I've heard, when they do Send in the Clowns, they sing, "Isn't it rich? Isn't it queer? Losing my timing this late in my career." Now, would you say it that way? Losing my timing this late in my career? You would say, losing my timing this late in my career, wouldn't you? But it's partly Sondheim's fault. I love him. I love him dearly. We had a long talk one night in the Carlisle about Bach. He's a great Bach enthusiast. But people have to use a little bit of imagination, a little bit of ingenuity. Isn't it rich? Isn't it queer? Losing my timing this late in my career. This is why I love songs.
I see what you mean with
that.
Did Sondheim agree with you?
I think so. In fact, I know he did, yes. Yes, he agreed with me completely.
When you're accompanying another, see, that's the word I was going to ask you about, is accompanying. When you're playing with another
singer. Same thing.
Yeah, do you see yourself as accompanying, though, or do you see yourself as both
musical
equals?
No, I see myself as participating,
mm-hmm.
but not intruding.
Mm-hmm.
And not intruding. I mean, accompanying is just, well, I have to play this, so I'll play it now. I mean, it is accompanying because you're not singing it with him. But, you know, there are these wonderful classical accompanists, like Dalton Baldwin and Gerald Moore and these people, who are truly a part of the performance, as I believe I am with Mel Torme. And we breathe together. We love Frederick Delius. We love Johann Sebastian Bach. We always say, two bodies and one musical mind. And it's true.
You've written songs as well, and I think your best known piece is Lullaby of Birdland. Can you tell us the story behind writing that?
Birdland needed a theme song for a 6-hour disc jockey show that they had in the early 50s.
And Birdland was a club in
yeah.
New York
mm-hmm.
in the 50s?
Right. Yes.
Mostly bop musicians playing
right.
it.
Right, yeah. Well, it was named for Charlie Parker, see, whose nickname was Bird. So I wrote this thing, I heard it in my head. I wrote it in 10 minutes. I always say 10 minutes and 35 years in the business. Over a steak in my dining room when I lived in New Jersey. I went back to that same butcher 1,000 times trying to get that same steak again. So they liked it, and they played it every hour on the hour, which is, of course, why it became my best-known song, because it's my only well-known song. You know, when I go on as a composer, I said, I'd like to play you a medley of my hit, you know. But the thing is that when something is hammered through people's heads, like, of course it's going to, if it's got any substance at all that people can hang on to, of course it's going to become a hit, you know. And that's what happened with Lullaby. And, of course, we got over 100 people recording it.
I don't know if you wrote it with a lyric in mind or not, but
no.
I have heard it sung.
Yes.
And the first line is, I'm not going to sing it, maybe you'll do it, but they sing the first line with Lullaby of Birdland in it.
Yes, they do.
Do you want to just sing the line just to?
Yeah. Well, if you read it and you read it as if you're dividing the lines, it's, Lullaby of Birdland, that's what I always hear when you sigh. Never in my wordland could there be ways to reveal in a phrase how I feel. Well, doesn't mean anything, does it, really? So, lullaby of birdland, that's what I always hear when you sigh. Never in my wordland could there be ways to reveal in a phrase how I feel. Now, it means something because it's being read.
Did you, when you composed the song, hear the first phrase as being lullaby of birdland?
No. No. I just thought of this as a tune. And in fact, I'm not even sure that, I mean, it was a theme song for Birdland. I don't even remember who gave it the title of Lullaby of Birdland. The song was written by, the lyric was written by a man named B.Y. Foster. And B.Y. Foster in real life is a man named George David Weiss, who wrote many things like Mr. Wonderful and stuff like that. And the reason he was B.Y. Foster, because at that time, if you belonged to ASCAP, as he did, you couldn't write for BMI. That's all changed now. So we don't need, alias-type names, you know, anymore. We don't need to do that.
When you first started living in the States in the 40s and the 50s, the jazz scene was having, jazz musicians were really having a lot of drug problems. There was a lot of heroin that was being used among jazz musicians then, and a lot of young musicians, partially, I think, to emulate some of their heroes like Charlie Parker, ended up shooting up and getting hooked on drugs. Did you ever run into any problems with that or come close to it? Was it hard for you to keep out of that?
Oh, no. I didn't drink. I didn't take a glass of wine until I was 46 years old. Never mind drugs or anything like that. I had people with me that took it. And provided they did their job, showed up on time and played as well as they would not. And that's a lot to ask. But if they could do it, it wasn't my business. I had a guy one night, and I'll protect him. I won't tell you his name. He called me about 3 o'clock in the morning. And he said, George, can I come up and see you for a minute? And I thought the manager had forgot to pay him or something, you know. So he came up. He sat on my bed. And he said, George. I said, yeah, but what's the matter? I'm on drugs. And he cried. And I said, so you're on drugs? Now, what? What does that mean? And he told me that he didn't want to stay around long enough for the shame to mar my band and my reputation. And I said, when you are straight, your job will be there. Well, time went on, and we never did get together again. And I understand he is very straight now. But I also understand that he's not playing anymore and that he's teaching, doing something. So I hope he is. But you see, he was guilty enough. He felt guilty enough. What am I going to do? I'm not his keeper. I can't use them when they're like that and when they're not doing the job.
Had you realized that he was on drugs? And did you consider saying, oh, that's okay, you can stay, you're still performing?
I just thought his playing was kind of weak.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't really do the job I imagine he could do. But I still waited, you know, in case he was going through a period of natural, you know, just not feeling up to par or something. And I'm patient, you know. And everybody protected him, of course. Wonderful group, you know.
You mentioned that you didn't drink, you didn't even have a glass of wine until you were 46.
Right.
Why not? Why not? have some wine or an occasional
drink. My mother drank more beer than she needed to drink. And in the neighborhood that I lived in, I saw a lot of, although my family were not involved, I saw a lot of street fighting and a lot of stuff going on. And I didn't need it. I was afraid. I didn't want to be involved in anything less than a life where I could really know where I was, coming from. And to this very day, I'm very conscious about knowing, what's going on at all times.
What made you think then at age 46 that it was okay at that point to have a drink? Did you feel secure enough within yourself so that you knew you could drink in moderation?
I think that was probably it.
You're living in New York now, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you've been in the States you've been a citizen, I guess, since the mid-50s.
56, you were. You hit it right on the nose.
Do you feel like New York's your town now? It was this fantasy place when you got there.
Oh, it really is my town, sure. We've been living there since 1978, we came back.
Do you have any troubles getting around? Did you use a guide dog or anything?
I used guide dog for 12 years. I had no trouble then. I have no trouble now because my wife comes with me everywhere.
There was an article. It was an article I think you wrote in the 50s, and it was called I Turned Down the Gift of Sight.
Mm-hmm.
What was that about?
It was some money-hungry, overzealous, publicity-hungry club owner who put it in, and it was totally untrue. And he took something out of context to the point where it brought a lot of unnecessary unhappiness to my family because they didn't understand it.
What was the story?
I just said then, as I say now, I am a grown, educated, secure human being who happens to be blind. And at this stage in my life, if there was any thought of getting my sight back, first of all, if it was successful, if the optimum of success were possible, I would still have to be totally re-educated. It's one thing to hear a car going by at 60 miles an hour. It's another thing to see it flash by your eyes, having never seen it for as many years as you've been shielded as a blind man. Reading and writing would be entirely different. The interpretation of color firsthand would have to be learned. If it were less than successful, my eyes may very well be disfigured. Out of this statement, he gathered that I had Good Samaritans offering to pay for the operation, and I was ungrateful enough to turn it down. And by the way, this is about the first time I've commented on it for all these years, because that story has lived with me for all these years, and there's so many other wonderful things to talk about. That my wife and I spend more hours in the day in absolutely compatible waking operation. We play bridge together. We go tandem cycling together. We cook together. I make the best Irish stew you'll ever have. And I'm very egotistical about it. She's a wonderful mezzo-soprano. Sings with a New York group called the New York Choral Artists. Does things like the B minor mass, with the New York Phil and Mater. I go to rehearsal and wave the Braille score at Mr. Mater and say, if the lights go out, call me. Isn't that better than talking about being ungrateful because of somebody?
But the one thing I don't understand about that article, had someone offered to you to give you their eyes or something?
Yeah, that's right. He was just a... I told you what he was. He was a publicity hungry.
So it's the guy from the club who offered to do that. I see.
I don't know whether he wanted to do it or whether... No, I don't think he wanted to do it. I think I think he just kind of made up that somebody wanted to do it and that I had turned it down. It was just a way of, you know, I tell you, frankly, I would get a much broader attention from people involved in publicizing if I ran down Fifth Avenue sticking needles in my arms. But if I can't get recognized for music and as a person, recognition beyond that, I don't need any more than I needed this extraneous story that he cooked up.
What do you play at home for pleasure? And I'm thinking of records and what you play at the piano. And I'm not talking about like rehearsal or practicing or if you still do that or anything
very
like that.
Very rarely do I touch the piano at home.
No, really?
No, I play so much when I work. You know, about 2 or 3 years ago, my wife and I went to Salzburg. And then we went to the Lake of Constance, and then we went to London. We were away for a month. I didn't touch a keyboard. We're going away for a month this year back to England. Going to do a different thing. We're going to go on the QE2 and rent a car in Southampton, drive through the New Forest, Devonshire, Cornwall, Bath, up through the Cotswolds, back to Heathrow, and then take the Concorde back. I won't touch a piano all that time. Be another month. What do I listen to? Bach, Mozart, Frederick Delius, Bartok, Ravel, Hindemith, and some jazz.
Is it refreshing to not touch a piano for a while?
Do
you feel renewed when you play again?
No, I feel fine. To me it is. I'm renewed again, as you say. Yes, I'm renewed when I play again.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us about your life and your playing today. Thank you very much for being here.
My pleasure. And if every interview had been as well prepared as the one you've just done, our job in promotion would be a much greater pleasure than we normally find it. Thank you. I hope we see you again.
Thank you. It's really been a pleasure to speak with you. My guest has been pianist George Shearing, and the occasion for his visit to Philadelphia today is a concert this evening he's going to play with singer Mel Torme, and they've been performing together for several years now. The concert is part of the Millen Jazz Festival. It's at the Academy of Music at 8 o'clock. And we'll give you a couple of phone numbers. At the Academy, it's 893-1930 for any information about future concerts for the Millen Jazz Festival. The Millen Jazz line is 751-9883. That's 751-9883. George Shearing is recording on the Concord record label now, and he has many recent albums on that record label. There's also a new reissue of his quintet sessions from the early 1950s that's just been put together on the Verve record label. Well, let's hear a recent recording featuring Mel Torme and George Shearing. And this is also on the Concord record label. This is Give Me the Simple Life.
I don't believe in fretting and grieving. Why mess around with strife? I guess I was cut out to step and strut out. Give me the simple life. It must be pleasant dining on pheasant using the proper knife. I want tomatoes and mashed potatoes. Give me the simple life. A cottage small is all I'm after, one that's spacious and wide. A heart that rings with joy and laughter with the ones you love inside. You take the high road, I'll take the low road, free from all care and strife. Sounds corny and seedy, but yes, indeedy, give me the simple life. Thank you. Cottage small is all I'm after, not one that's spacious and wide. A house that rings with joy and laughter, and the one you love inside. You take the high road, I'll take the low road, free from all care and strife. Sounds corny and seedy, but yes, indeed. Give me the simple.
That was George Shearing and Mel Torme, who performed together this evening at the Academy of Music. Well, it's 3 minutes after 4 o'clock. This is Fresh Air, and you're tuned to WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. Well, coming up, we're going to hear a National Press Club address that was given earlier today by Senator Richard Lugar, who is the chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and he spoke to the National Press Club about Nicaragua. We're going to hear his address and the question and answer period which followed. Support for this edition of the National Press Club comes from the National Public Radio News and Information Fund. Contributors to the fund include the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, Changing Times, the monthly magazine of personal money management from Kiplinger, Mead Data Central for NexusLexis and Metis Research Services, and National Journal, publisher of the 1986 Almanac of American Politics. This is the National Press Club broadcast.
Today's speaker is considered one of the true intellectual heavyweights in the Senate today. A look at his record shows why. He graduated first at his Shortridge High School in Indianapolis, was first in his class again at Denison University of Ohio. He earned a Rhodes Scholarship to Oxford and received a master's degree in politics, economics, and philosophy from Pembroke College. On returning home, Lugar volunteered for active duty in the United States Navy, where for 3 years he served as, you might guess, an intelligence briefer for Admiral Arleigh Burke, Chief of Naval Operations at that time. 1964, Senator Lugar made his first bid for elective office, running successfully for the Indianapolis School Board, the level of government where really important decisions are made. 3 years later, he was elected mayor of Indianapolis in an upset victory over a Democratic incumbent. He was reelected in 1971, served as president of the National League of Cities, and became widely known as Richard Nixon's favorite mayor. Elected to the Senate in 1976, he worked closely with then-Majority Leader Howard Baker. He managed Baker's short-lived presidential campaign in 1980, but gave such a good account of himself that he was widely mentioned at the time as a running mate for Ronald Reagan. During his first term in the Senate, he played a leading role in gaining passage of loan guarantees for New York City and the Chrysler Corporation. In foreign affairs, he has been a strong advocate of NATO, free but fair trade, and a strong defense. This is Senator Lugar's fifth appearance at a National Press Club luncheon. He first addressed us as the bright young mayor who revitalized Indianapolis, then as a newly elected senator, and again as chairman of the Republican Senatorial Campaign Committee. His most recent address was in January 1985 as he assumed the chairmanship of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Then he predicted that the committee, quote, is about to enjoy an extraordinary period of education, decision-making, and achievement, close quote. By most bipartisan critiques today, what seemed to be a somewhat audacious prognostication at the time has turned out to be right on the money. Senator Lugar today has emerged as one of the bright new leaders of the United States Senate, primarily because his thoughtful and balanced approach to foreign relations has restored the luster and influence of what had become a somewhat moribund committee. Indeed, many foreign policy experts now say the committee enjoys its highest prestige since the days it was headed by a member of today's audience, former Senator J. William Fulbright of Arkansas. Senator Lugar, for instance, is widely credited with playing a key role in the events that led to the peaceful ouster of Ferdinand Marcos and the restoration of democracy in the Philippines under the presidency of Corazon Aquino. And he has hardened considerably the administration's policy of constructive engagement towards the apartheid regime in South Africa, trying to model a new formula that eventually will result in democracy for all the people of that troubled country. While Senator Lugar likely will receive numerous questions about those two nations, the main thrust of his comments today concerns the possibility of restoring democracy in Nicaragua. Senator Lugar, welcome once more to the podium of the National Press Club Newsmaker Luncheon.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Madam President, thank you very much for your thoughtful introduction. I share your personal thrill that Senator Fulbright is a member of our audience today. As some of you know, Bill Fulbright was a Rhodes Scholar at Pembroke College, Oxford, shared the same tutor in politics, R.B. McCallum, at R.B.'s early years that I did in R.B.'s later years. I wrote to him as a student at Pembroke College, and he graciously returned my questions with thoughtful replies, and at the time of his retirement, still had those letters in his file, and I cherish that association. I'm delighted to have this opportunity to be with him and all of you. Let me just comment that 17 months ago, I addressed this club as the new chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and to many political and foreign policy commentators suggested then that the foreign policy debate was unfortunately fractious in the Congress and in the administration because the Foreign Relations Committee had lost much of its sense of direction and confidence and thus its prestige and power. The committee began the 99th Congress with a series of well-attended and well-reported hearings reviewing the overall direction of American foreign policy. And I would suggest a spirit of boldness combined with senatorial comedy developed in those hearings. The committee has proceeded to establish a strong record of bipartisan leadership on a large majority of tough foreign policy issues. We passed the first foreign assistance bill in 4 years with 75 votes on the Senate floor. We reasserted the committee's policymaking powers by shaping and approving a number of funding authorization bills. We're